Hello and welcome back to another edition of the Dog and Duck Show. The dogs and the ducks are flying high, both ranked in the top 10 heading into the beginning of Pac-12 play. Mark, this is the last first opener of Pac-12 football that we're ever going to see. And you're the historian, you're the author. How are you feeling, and what is the significance of all this?
Well, Warren, first of all, I'm feeling fantastic, incredibly excited about the dawn of the Pac-12 conference in all of its glory. It's historic, Warren. I mean, we're talking about entering conference play with eight teams who are undefeated, eight teams that are ranked in the AP top 25. That has never happened before in conference history until the last 2 weeks.
Top 22.
So yeah. Even not even needing to like sneak in there at number 25. Right. So that's never happened before. The Pac-12 has been by far the most impressive conference, you know, top to bottom. And so maybe not all the way to the bottom. Stanford lost to Sacramento State, but it's a great, great season for the Pac-12 so far. And now we're into conference play, and Warren, it gets real right off the bat. We've got obviously Colorado coming into Oregon is the game that I'm most excited about. But you've also got UCLA going to Utah, mm-hmm. and both of those teams starting a true freshman quarterback, it looks like, in that game. You've got the Beavers going up and playing their Pac-2 rivals, the Washington State Cougars, in a really important game for those two schools. So we're talking about, these eight teams coming in with, like, some sort of aspirations of competing for a conference title. And by the end of the day Saturday, three of those teams are going to feel like their conference title hopes are on life support just by virtue of having taken a loss in the first game of conference play. And it's only going to intensify from there. If you play out the schedule, I mean, each week seems to have one or three of these just incredible matchups. So I'm just so excited for it. I'm really looking forward to it.
Well, you're absolutely right. And, you know, when you talk about eight teams out of 12, the top 22, what that means is that there's going to be some battle royales throughout this year, and not everybody can stay there. There's no way that with this much talent that there's going to be eight teams sitting in the top 22 at the end of the year. So what that means is that we're either going to see a year where some truly dominant teams arise amidst a very, very competitive Pac-12, or the conference does what the conference has done over the years, and it eats itself alive, where at the end of the year, even the top teams have, you know, amassed two, three losses within their own conference. So I think this is a really interesting week to look at. Like you said, you know, you've got an undefeated Colorado coming into play, an undefeated Oregon, both are ranked. You've got an undefeated Washington State that I think their hopes right now are through the roof because of the way that Cam Ward has performed and the defense has continued to improve. And then Oregon State, they believe. Right. I mean, they've got DJU, and that's the missing piece in their mind.
Right.
So, you know, like you said, someone's going to come home undefeated. The only teams that I would say, like, I would say the one team that could maybe potentially sustain a loss better than anyone else is Utah. Because, you know, you got to believe that Cam Rising has got to be pretty close to coming back. They lose an early season game to UCLA with a true freshman quarterback.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's Kyle Whittingham. You know, he's the captain of the ship. They get their general back, and, you know, they go on a roll end of season. But some big, big, big games this weekend, and we're here to cover it. We are the Dog and Duck Show. So, Mark, let's get into it. And, man, we're looking ahead to some fireworks, but before we do, let's look back at what was some pretty explosive football over the weekend, particularly with the Washington Huskies firing on all cylinders, going into East Lansing to take down the distracted, maybe to put it, Michigan State Spartans. Certainly, they looked shell-shocked from the moment that the Huskies drove down and scored on the first series.
Yeah, so this was interesting to me, Warren, because we've seen examples as recently as, you know, that game against the Sun Devils last year, but we've seen it in other instances. USC under Ed Orgeron comes to mind, where a program appoints an interim coach and it kind of gives them a jolt of life. But I think that that usually comes when a program has been losing consistently. They kind of get the old regime out, they elevate an energetic assistant coach, and that gives the team a new bounce and a new life and a new energy. Michigan State, I was not playing with that set of cards. They had an entrenched coach with a long-term contract who had a roster that had committed to play for him. They were off to a 2-0 start to their season, and I think hoping to kind of turn things around after a pretty disappointing year last year. And so then to have your coach fired, not for like on-field things, you know, there's a difference of firing this coach because you're losing games and now we're replacing him with somebody else. You can see how that might give a team a boost. In this case, he's fired for some off-field scandal. And like you said, the players just kind of come out and shell-shocked. I think it's more similar to like how we've seen from Northwestern this year, who had Pat Fitzgerald get fired in the offseason. And they have been a train wreck this year. You know, they just have been totally non-competitive. And
like you said, I mean, you know, there were certainly some shades of last year's Arizona State game where, you know, if you remember, the defensive backfield was decimated for the Washington Huskies. They had guys running out there without a name on the back of their jersey. And before the game, word starts getting out, Devon Banks, who was looking like he was our, you know, second best defensive back, out for the season. Mateo Mele, our center, out for the season. We're hearing that Asa Turner is not going to be back, starting safety. Cam Fab, Asa Turner's backup, is out for this game. And certainly among Husky faithful, there was a sense of, uh-oh, this, you know, feels a little bit too familiar. On the road, grass field, replaced coach, the team's going to galvanize, we're going to get exposed. But the Huskies were having none of it. Penix, Polk, Odunze, McMillan come out with guns blazing. And by the end of the first half, it was 35-0. The Huskies had stepped on the Spartans' throat. My brother-in-law, who is a Spartan alumni, sends a screenshot of the score at halftime with some sad sack comment underneath. And it was over. And I mean, the student section was gone by the beginning of the third quarter. And so the Huskies scored a couple more field goals, took their foot off the gas, and the rest was history. But boy, even though this game was on the Peacock network and very difficult to watch on television, unless you were really trying like I was and like Husky faithful was, everybody was talking about Michael Penix by the end of the day on Saturday.
Just, I mean, an incredible performance. I think that I said this to you via text. You did not appreciate this, but I said that the Huskies look like the best team in the country, and you told me to pump the brakes. And now this is not me. This is not me blowing smoke. This is me just looking like objectively at all of the other top teams in the first 3 weeks had one game where they just kind of didn't seem to be all there. You know, Florida State almost lost to Boston College. Georgia fell behind at the half against South Carolina. Texas was tied at the half against Wyoming. Michigan was kind of sleepwalking through their game against Bowling Green. Like, and that sort of thing happens. Or you have a team like Oregon, who had a real fight with Texas Tech and, you know, survived by the skin of their teeth. Like, now USC hasn't really been challenged, but USC has not played anybody of note.
Mm-hmm.
Washington, on the other hand, has played a Mountain West school in Boise State that is generally one of the top two or three teams in that league. And playing Michigan State, a Big Ten team that, granted, is coming off of a tough season, but is generally like a bowl-eligible Big Ten team.
Yeah, and I mean, Mark, I mean, I don't think anybody at the end of the season is going to look back and say, oh, Michigan State was a really good team.
Yeah.
But going into the game on Saturday, their quarterback, Noah Kim, had won the offensive player of the week for the Big 12, the Big 10 the previous week. And their running back, Noah Carter, was the second leading runner in the Big 10. So it wasn't like they were total garbage. Like they were doing well against the competition that they had played against. Yeah. So there was no reason to think that they would crumple like they did against the Huskies.
Well, I mean, our guy, Tony Castricone, did I pronounce that right, Tony?
Castricone, no E at the end.
Don't do the E, yeah, okay. So Tony Castricone.
Castricone.
Our listeners should give him a follow on Twitter, if they're Husky, if they're Duck fans, they may not want to, but they should give him a follow on Twitter because he had a lot of great stats about just the absurd statistical output of the Huskies offense. And the one that caught my mind, Warren, which I'm sure you were going to get to, but I'll tee you up for it, is this is the second true road game in a row in which the Huskies have totaled over 700 yards of offense. And the only other team to do that in the last, year, since the beginning of last season, in a road environment against a Power Five team, is Ole Miss. Lane Kiffin's Ole Miss did it to Arkansas. That's like in the last 2.5 seasons now that we're going on. So over 700 yards in the Apple Cup in that domination of the Cougars at the end of last season. Their next true road game was this game in East Lansing, where they, 713 yards of offense. Like,
yeah,
that's crazy, Warren, to have back-to-back road games against decent teams where you're putting up 700 yards of offense. That is insane.
It's more than any team has ever put up against Michigan State. It's the second most that the Huskies have ever put up in a game. The number one was the Corey Dillon San Jose State game, where he ran for over 200 yards in the first quarter. But this is something totally different. And, deservedly so, Michael Penix Jr. won the Walter Camp National Player of the Week honor, joining a pretty select group of five Huskies who have won that award since 2009. And so congratulations to him. Odunze, Polk, and Jalen McMillan, those three guys are on pace to each have over 1,200 receiving yards at the end of the season. And how about my guy, our local Mount Si High School walk-on, Jack Westover? He had three touchdown receptions on Saturday and leads the Huskies in touchdown receptions. So you think about those three Biletnikoff-caliber receivers, and the leading touchdown receiver right now on the team is a former walk-on tight end named Jack Westover, who is literally a jack of all trades. He blocks, he runs, he's a fullback, a tight end, and certainly a weapon that, you know, Michael Penix and Ryan Grubb have really unlocked and are using as a great antidote for any team that wants to, you know, drop back and protect, you know, the deep ball. And so it's a beautiful thing to see. And, you know, our friend J.J. Vansel texted me earlier today, you know, and he said, we truly are living in a special time with a transcendent player like Michael Penix Jr. And I agree, but I think it's more than that. I think it's, you know, we have that transcendent player in Penix, but this is the best receiving trio we've ever had. Ryan Grubb is the best offensive coordinator who has ever called plays at the University of Washington. And we've got an offensive line that's top tier, to say the least, in terms of Husky history, tight ends that are top tier. The jury is still out on the running backs, but this past Saturday, Dylan Johnson looked explosive with 71 yards on 8 rushes. Tybo Rogers came in the second half. He looked like the best runner that we've got on this roster with over 75 yards on 15 rushes and cleanup duty. And Will Nixon caught a touchdown pass that got turned back or overturned because of a ticky-tack penalty on Jalen McMillan. But if those guys can be above average, you know, if they can, if they can put up 150 rushing yards per game, there's no way any team's going to be able to slow this Husky offense down. So then the question is, can this defense do what they need to do? And so far, the early returns, Mark, are this is a vastly improved Husky defense. Jabbar Muhammad is by far a major upgrade over Jordan Perryman last year. And Thaddeus Dixon, Elijah Jackson, unfortunately, Devon Banks is out for the season. But those guys have shown dramatic improvement. ZTF came back on Saturday after being out the previous week. He puts up 2 sacks. Looks like the ZTF of 2020, where it seemed like every time he touched the ball, he forced a strip sack or a fumble. And Braylon Trice really hasn't even gotten going yet. And so I think we still haven't seen them tested against a quality passing offense. Boise State's passing offense was nothing to speak of. Neither was Tulsa. And I don't know what to make out of Noah Kim and Michigan State, but those guys did not look like they belonged on the same field. California won't really tell us a lot in terms of their offense against our defense. So we may not really know what that passing defense looks like until we face Arizona or even more so Oregon. But like I said, early returns, this is as encouraging as you could get in terms of what you would want to see from the Husky defense.
Yeah, just to kind of go back to your point about the offense real quick, because I think what the defense is doing is a big story. I want to cover that. But you mentioned kind of the recognition of like, oh, we're rooting for a transcendent player, and then you caught yourself and it was like, no, it's a group of players, you know, that are all kind of together at the same time and this unbelievable receiving core. And it actually made me think that because I've been in conversation with multiple Husky fans, and they have referenced to me, like, basically saying, like, is this what it felt like when you were rooting for the Chip Kelly Oregon Ducks? Like, in terms of, like, you turn on this offense and you're just kind of in awe game after game of what it can do. And I was thinking of it's the reverse of that, in that those Duck teams ran the ball and this Husky team throws the ball. And so, but it was like, I was looking back at like the 2011 Ducks, where they had LaMichael James had over 2,000 yards of total offense. Kenyon Barner and DeAnthony Thomas both had over 1,000 yards. So they had all three of those guys in the same backfield. And then they had this handful of receivers that were just kind of you know, 400 yards in a season or something like that, you know? But by committee, they pieced it together. And I feel like that's what the Huskies need out of their running backs. They don't need one of those guys to step forward and be a 1,000-yard rusher. They just need three different guys that they can hand the ball to that are going to average 5 yards a carry, that are going to make the first person miss on occasion and surge ahead and fall forward. Because the offensive line and the quarterback and the receiving positions are so, so good that that says it all. So, it really is a historically good offense that I mean, if I were to make the list of the offenses that have kind of captivated me on this level, it would be a very, very short list. And so, but that's, we knew all that, right, Warren? We knew coming into the year that it was going to be a great quarterback and a great receiving core. I think it's the defense, especially in this Michigan State game, that made me go, okay, the ceiling for this Washington team might be different than I was expecting coming into the year. Mm-hmm. Whereas I came into the year thinking the defense could still be exploited in some different ways. All of those issues that they had last year couldn't have just been fixed. But the defense has looked really good, Warren. They've looked really good.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned the running game, and it just reminded me of a conversation we had at the end of last season, because really, like, if you talk to most Husky fans last year, middle of the season, they would have said, Wayne Talapapa, okay. Cam Davis, okay. But by the end of the season, Wayne Talapapa ran for 411 yards and 5 touchdowns on 48 carries for an average of 8.6 yards per carry in his final 4 games. And that put him on a pace for, you know, over a 1,200-yard rushing season. He finished with over 1,000 combined yards last year. And I just say that to say that, you know, it didn't really seem like the running game was going to amount to anything at the beginning of the season. But I think that, you know, the way I would describe it is that the Grubb philosophy is you pass to set up the run. And I think that there's a sense in which they do that during a game, but in many ways, I think that they're doing that for the whole season. And so I would not be surprised as the season goes on, defensive coordinators for opposing Pac-12 teams say, we've got to drop men back. We've got to stop this explosive passing offense. And all of a sudden we start seeing Dylan Johnson running for 100 yards, you know, Will Nixon finishing with 90 yards combined running and receiving, you know, Tybo Rogers is getting in there and getting 50 or 60 yards per game and kind of these third quarter gashes, you know. And so I, what was interesting last year was how many, you know, touchdowns Cam Davis and Wayne Talapapa scored from within the 5-yard line, where they were kind of like the finishers. They were the hammer that nailed it in. So it is an interesting dynamic to see what will happen with that over the course of the season. Will the Huskies just, you know, throw for like 6,000 yards this year and forget the run altogether? Or will we see the pendulum swing back as teams adjust over the course of the season, the weather changes, all that kind of good stuff? So it's a fun thing to talk about. And like you said, if you're a Husky fan, you got to be loving this. You got to cherish it. You got to enjoy it, because who knows how much longer we'll get to have this kind of a ride. But certainly the 3 games into the season, Michael Penix's decision to return, Odunze, McMillan, you know, the offensive line, all those guys, their willingness to come back. They have got to be so happy with the decision that they've made thus far into the season.
Yeah. I mean, I started by saying they look like the best team in the country, and all of that is to say that they've passed every test thus far. You could not be more pleased through three games than how this team has played. Still plenty of tests to come. They certainly haven't played anywhere close to the best teams on their schedule yet. But I think there's a lot of reason for optimism if you're a Husky fan, and if I'm honest as a Duck fan, there's reason for apprehension. That it's, you know, I won't tell you the text that I sent to my fellow Duck friends as we're watching the score of that Michigan State game increase, but it was, you know, along the lines of like, this is not what we want to see out of our
well.
So
let's talk a little bit about the Ducks, because obviously they put up a bunch of points against an overmatched Hawaii Rainbow Warrior squad on Saturday, 55-10. Mark, I picked up a few of the highlights. It felt like it was Bo being Bo. It was Franklin being Franklin. It was Bucky being Bucky. Was there anything, you know, compelling or you know, story worthy in terms of what the Ducks did on Saturday?
Well, one thing that I think is compelling that you may not know, Warren, is that they snapped a three-game losing streak that they had going on against Hawaii. So this was, you know, Hawaii has had Oregon's number going back, I think 1988 was when that three-game losing streak started. So
that's crazy. I had no idea.
Yeah, I think it was like 80, 90, and 94 or something like that. So it was all in kind of that late Rich Brooks era. But one of those years, they 1994 was the year Oregon reached the Rose Bowl, and that year started with a 20-point loss to Hawaii. So yeah, Hawaii did have Oregon's number way back in the day. They haven't played for 30 years, but obviously not much to take from that in terms of this. I think the two storylines, if you're looking for on the positive side, Hawaii, you know, has that run and shoot offense. They came in averaging over 320 yards per game through the air. You figured they were going to throw it 45 times a game, that they were going to take a few deep shots. I think I said to you, you know, yeah, if Oregon gives up 17 points because they gave up a few deep shots, I'll actually consider that a win because I think Hawaii is going to get their yardage. Well, Hawaii only passed for 142 yards.
Yeah.
I think almost half of that came in the fourth quarter when Oregon had called off the dogs by that point. Cause I think their passing yardage was in the 80s heading into the fourth quarter. So that was just not a factor at all. Now, Oregon's going to face much better quarterbacks, including this coming weekend, which will tell us a lot more about whether the secondary really has improved significantly over last year. But I just don't think last year's secondary would have gotten out of that game just completely shutting down the Hawaii passing game the way that this did. So I think that's a small reason for some sort of optimism. On the reverse side, the big issue for Oregon coming out of the Texas Tech game was 14 penalties, many of them just kind of brain bust type penalties. Well, they committed 9 penalties against Hawaii, which is a little better, but not a lot better, especially against an inferior opponent. Mm-hmm. And Dan Lanning started his press conference saying how disappointed he was. It kept getting asked to him, and he kept having to go back to how frustrated he was with the penalties. And finally, a reporter mentioned something about, I know you don't want to talk about the penalties anymore, or something about that. And then Lanning said, this was the line that caught my attention, Warren. He said, well, we better not be talking about it next week. I'm not going to do the same thing again and again and expect a different result. So we're going to do something different. We're going to figure out if we can get it fixed. If we can't, they can't be on the field. If you're going to get penalties, you can't be on the field. It's going to be that simple. If you get a penalty, you can't play for us. You're hurting the team. So there was clearly this frustration that came through where I have a feeling it was some penalties more than others, right? Like some penalties in the heat of battle, you don't mind as much as the total brain bust guy lining up in the wrong place, or the guy letting his emotions get the best of him and lashing out at another player. I think those are the ones where he was especially frustrated. And so this is clearly a point, you know, to come out of a 45-point win and have the head coach start the press conference by just hammering this one thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was of note.
Yeah. And I mean, Mark, I wonder, you just on a personal level, what are your thoughts about that kind of demeanor from your head coach? You know, because I don't listen to all of Dan Lanning's press conferences. You know, I'm a passive observer, but you know, there seemed like there were some rumblings before the season began about how Lanning seemed frustrated in talking with the media, that he had really limited access. I just get the sense that he doesn't seem to be having a lot of fun. Am I wrong in that assessment?
Well, I don't think media interviews are particularly his favorite thing. I think he has more of a sense of humor than some people give him credit for, but I think it comes out in different ways. Like if you listen to his coach's show with the two Oregon broadcasters, Jerry Allen and Mike Jorgensen, he is much more relaxed. He's much more open in answering questions. He's much more willing to crack a joke. You know, before the Texas Tech game, he made a crack about being more of a flour guy than a corn guy when it comes to tortillas, because they throw the tortillas on the field. Like, you know, I think he is a fun guy in his normal day-to-day life. And I think in general, when you hear him in a press conference, he is very even keel. He is very much like, if you ask him about virtually any player, he'll say, well, gosh, I thought he made some great plays, and I think there's some plays he'd like to have back. You know, that's kind of his standard line, which is essentially like, I'm proud of him. And also there's more to be done. There's more to be done. This was the first moment where really in any press conference where I've seen a hint of like, I'm identifying something that cannot happen again. Mm-hmm. And I think that in his mind, he's looking down the road and he's like, for instance, right before the half, Hawaii had not scored the entire half. And they line up for a field goal. They miss the field goal, but an Oregon defender had lined up offsides. And so they got to reattempt the kick, and they made the kick, and it ruined the shutout going into the half. And Lanning wasn't happy about that. He said it on the video broadcast as he's going into the locker room. And I think he's looking down the road at this gauntlet of a schedule. And he has said as much after the Texas Tech game, which is like, at some point, we're going to face an opponent that doesn't let us off the hook if we make these kinds of mistakes.
Right.
So the things like lining up in the wrong place and giving a team an extra chance at a field goal, that could be really costly against Washington or Utah. Having a guy lash out and get a personal foul penalty over on the sideline, that could be really costly against USC. So I think he's looking at these moments against the Portland States and the Hawaiis, and he's saying, let's really go after this now.
Mm.
Let's really make this a teachable moment now. A lot of teams are very teachable after they finally lose a game, right? That a lot of times that's when you see a team improve the most, is after that first loss. I think what he's really trying to hone in on is after these blowout wins, when it seems like everything went well, we're going to especially hard on them. Just to try to keep them engaged and focused on kind of that bigger goal ahead of them. So I think that's the take that he's got right now.
And, you know, I mean, there have been so many coaches both in the NFL and in college football that they've done it their way. They have a certain style, certain personality, and it's worked for them. It's worked for their team. But do you think that kind of, you know, taking all of this frustration, you know, public, does that help the, you know, the demeanor of the team? You know, like if you're a player and you're thinking, if I make a mistake, I'm off the field, does that help you play your best, or does that you know, potentially cause you to be a little bit less free, a little bit less, you know, able to let it go and just let your ability take over?
I think time will tell on that, right? Like, we'll see in the Colorado game if this team looks sharper. And it'll be interesting to kind of gauge the sidelines interactions of him and his players. My understanding is Lanning's players really, really love him and would go to wall for him, and that there's a real deep connection there. Multiple players have talked about how accessible he is, how you can go in and just kind of talk to him about things unrelated to football, and how all up and down the team, guys feel that way about him, feel an accessibility around him. I think there's a reason, there's a genuineness that comes through in his recruiting efforts where guys really feel like he's a guy that they want to play for. So I think if you've built up that kind of capital with your players, I think you can use a little of it in a, and I think this may be a little calculated. It may be a little bit like, yeah, we're coming off of a 45-point win and I don't want them too comfortable. And I'm identifying this one thing.
Right. We're going to tighten the screws on this. Yeah.
So
they're number 10 in the nation. They're undefeated. The offense is just as dynamic as it was last year. The defense looks like it's improved. Very similar to everything we discussed with the Huskies, it's got to be all optimism for Duck fans out there. And this Saturday, you know, you're taking, you know, Hype U and pitting them up against the king of hype himself, Coach Prime. Like, the ratings have got to be through the roof for this game on Saturday, right?
Well, consider that their late night game against Colorado State drew over 9 million viewers, which is by far the most watched, you know, late night college football game ever. Those Pac-12 after dark games typically draw like 1.5 million viewers. Wow. And the Colorado games drew 9 million viewers. So this is a phenomenon, you know? I mean, this is something unlike anything we've seen. That when they show a clip of Deion Sanders giving his post game talk in the locker room and Dwayne the Rock Johnson is just standing next to him. It's just kind of, it's a different world. And so it is funny, I think, that, this Deion has very much built a brand for himself and now for his team. And who are they drawing as they're kind of at their peak of their fame now, heading into Pac-12 play? But they're drawing, I think, the school that has cultivated a brand as much as anything else. And both heavily influenced by Nike. It'll be interesting if Phil Knight has a rooting interest here, because there are relationships on both sides.
I mean, he's got to be loving it. I mean, come on. It's like the Nike extravaganza.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a win-win for him.
Well, and I think for the people that really love Deion, I think this is the game that they've been waiting for. I ran into a guy, Warren, in the Safeway parking lot. I'm walking through the parking lot with my Oregon sweatshirt on, and I hear a guy say something about, hey, how's your team looking? And I turn around, and this guy, and he's wearing a Chicago Bulls jersey, an Atlanta Braves jacket, and an Alabama Crimson Tide hat. And I come to find out that he actually played cornerback at Eastern Washington in the Vernon Adams Cooper Cup era. So it was on some good Eastern Washington teams. Yeah. And apparently is a fan of all of these other teams as well. But you know what? The thing that he wanted to talk about was Deion, and when does Deion play Oregon? That's what he was most interested in. And I think for the people that have been drawn into the Deion hype, why would you not want to see them play the team that is constantly changing uniforms and doing all kinds of, you know, putting up billboards? And I mean, it's like they're a pair that was meant for each other in some ways.
I mean, no one thought that Colorado was going to come into this game 3-0 except for Deion Sanders. And yet here they are. They're ranked in the top, 22, ranked number 19 in the nation. They've upset 17 ranked TCU. They got took care of business against Nebraska. Won a thriller in overtime against in-state rival Colorado State, who really, I mean, you want to talk about Colorado State taking things personally. Those guys were, I mean, there was some kind of bounty gate going on in that game. And yet they've weathered the storm to get to this point against Oregon. And, you know, Mark, we were talking about this a little bit off the air, but, you know, Las Vegas has yet to pin down what to do with this Colorado Buffaloes team when it comes to serving up the odds. And Oregon's coming in as a 21-point favorite, which I get it. Like, I mean, they've got way more talent. They've got, you know, they're at home. They've got way more going for them. Maybe they do expose Colorado and you know, beat the pants off of them. But thus far, every time, you know, someone's tried to prove Colorado to be a fraud into the season, they have proven themselves to be the real deal.
Well, I mean, yes and no. I think what's been interesting is Vegas has been wrong on both sides of it with Colorado. They pick right. them to by 21 against TCU, and they win by 3. They pick them to beat Colorado State by 21, and they barely force overtime. And so,
when you think about that, like that game, like if Las Vegas had watched that game like beforehand, you know, like if they could have understood what Colorado State, you know, was going to put into that game, like what that game meant to yeah. Colorado State, I don't think that they would have put those odds on the game.
It was their Super Bowl. Yeah.
It was their Super Bowl times 10. Yeah. I mean, like those guys were willing to die on the field to win that game.
Or willing Saturday to night.
Exactly. I mean, they were throwing their bodies around like there was no tomorrow. And they were not only throwing their bodies around, they were throwing Colorado bodies like Travis Hunter, who's sadly out now for what, a few weeks. So, you know, obviously, yeah, the Las Vegas has not been able to pin that down, which to me leans into this question of, you know, with Oregon being a 21-point favorite, does that feel accurate to you?
So I asked a buddy of this question today, because you've got Oregon this week and you've got USC next week at home if you're Colorado. And I said, would you be more surprised if I told you Colorado won one of those games? Or would you be more surprised if I told you Colorado lost both of those games by 4 touchdowns? And we settled, maybe you'll disagree with this, Warren, but we settled on losing both of those games by 4 touchdowns would be less surprising than them beating either Oregon or USC. Would you agree with that? In essence, like if I told you Colorado yeah. lost to Oregon 49-21 and then lost to USC 56-28, would that?
Yeah. Really are they playing USC at in Los Angeles?
That game's at home. It's in Boulder.
Okay. So I honestly would say that I would be less surprised if they ended up winning one of those two games, particularly against USC.
Interesting.
Because I think USC's defense is, you know, potentially an Achilles heel for them. And with, you know, Shedeur Sanders and what they've been able to do offensively, you know, and then being at home, I could see that being a game where USC stumbles. Now, I would have never said that at the beginning of the season, but based on what we've seen thus far, I could see that being the kind of game. Like, I mean, USC lost to Washington when they were down a couple times, because these, you know, these five-star guys kind of just think that they can kind of waltz in and waltz out. And then, you know, like you said, for some team, this is their Super Bowl and they get caught with their pants down. And Lincoln Riley, you know, fantastic coach, but I think that those kind of things can happen when you've got that kind of a, the way that that team is constructed. I would not predict a Colorado victory against Oregon in Autzen Stadium. I think that would be foolish, but I'm not convinced that the Ducks are going to win by 21 points. But if they do, I won't be like shocked at all.
I think if you're talking yourself into Colorado, you're talking yourself into Shador Sanders is like a legit Heisman candidate that he's going to throw for 400 yards or something like that and really like keep his team in the game, and that the Colorado defense is probably going to give up a lot of yards and a lot of points, but they're going to force a couple key turnovers. Maybe Deion Sun is going to have another pick six like he did last week, that they're going to get a few timely plays from the defense and that they're going to win a shootout. That kind of feels like if they're going to have any shot, that's the way it's going to have to come, is they just kind of outscore someone.
Yeah. And I'll just say this, and we can move on if you want to, but after I watched week one of the Colorado TCU matchup, what I texted some of the guys on our thread was, I said, Colorado has hit on every single key guy that they got over the offseason. They hit on Shador Sanders. They hit on Travis Hunter. They hit on Dylan Edwards. And then they hit on Shiloh Sanders. Like, all four of those guys against TCU played like they were all Americans.
Yeah.
And the question that I had coming out of that game was, number one, can those guys sustain that level of performance all year long? But really, the more realistic question was, what happens if any of those guys get hurt?
Right.
You know, because you've got Travis Hunter playing something like 140 plays in a game, and he's, you know, on pace to have 1,000 yards receiving and be an All-American cornerback at the same time. And it's not about talent. The talent's obvious, but the human body can only sustain so much. And of course he got taken out in a cheap way, but the likelihood of someone like that being able to make it through a whole season, putting out that kind of effort, seems pretty unfathomable. So, you know, out of that fearsome foursome, one of those guys is already out for Oregon.
It's basically two of those guys because he plays two positions. So,
yeah. Well, yeah, but I mean, you know, Shador, Dylan, Shiloh, and Travis. Right, so right. Travis is kind of like four and five, right, if you will. Exactly. But yeah, to your point, he's out now. So, you know, if one of those other guys gets hurt, they just don't have the depth to recover from that. So, I'm picking the Ducks to win this game on Saturday. And honestly, I hope they win this game I think, you know, assuming the Huskies take care of business with Cal and with Arizona, you know, let's go into that big rivalry game with both teams undefeated. You know, that would be, I think, my preference at this point. But certainly we've learned at this point, do not count out Deion Sanders and what he can do.
Yeah, I certainly wouldn't want to count him out. I think the one thing I will offer, and then we can move on to your Washington-Cal game. You mentioned several skill players. You didn't mention any offensive linemen. You didn't mention any defensive linemen. And I think if Oregon turns this game into a rout, it will be because there's a significant advantage at the line of scrimmage on both sides of the ball. And Colorado has shown a real weakness stopping the run on defense. And on offense, Colorado has really struggled to predict protect Shedeur Sanders. I think they've given up at least 4 sacks in every game. They're one of the worst teams in the country in giving up sacks. And that's something that Oregon has made a real commitment to this year. We saw them against Texas Tech. They really got after Tyler Shuck. I imagine they're really going to get after Shedeur Sanders. They're going to be coming at him from all angles and chasing him around the field. And I think the other thing that just has to be mentioned is that Colorado is playing for the 4th straight week in a game under an immense spotlight.
Mm-hmm.
They were the big noon kickoff 3 weeks in a row. You had ESPN game day was in town. 60 Minutes was in town. they're just getting it from all angles. And now they have this huge game at Autzen with a huge game against USC looming. And that is such a different emotional cost for these 18 to 22 year old guys that haven't really been used to that. If you think about what life has been like, say for Oregon, where they had Portland State and they had Hawaii, like they had to really get up to go to Texas Tech, but they've been able to kind of power down a little bit, get their work in, and now they're firing back up. Can Colorado really play at that maximum intensity level for 4 weeks, 5 weeks in a row without having a noticeable drop? That would really, really surprise me if they were to kind of keep that level of intensity going. I know Deion can do it because Deion prime time. He's a guy that'll play in a Major League Baseball game and an NFL game in the same day. You know, he's played in the World Series and the Super Bowl. Like, he's not going to back down from the spotlight. I'm just not sure that all of his players are quite built for that at this point.
Well, like you said, he's used to the prime time. He's used to the performing and getting up for every game. And certainly this is going to be a game on Saturday for the Huskies where they're facing a Cal team that should not really pose a serious threat to their season. But on closer inspection, this Cal team has been a constant thorn in the side for the Huskies over the last several years, really during the Justin Wilcox era. And, you mentioned Tony Castricone. He posted a tweet earlier this week where he shared that UW and Cal have the last 4 games have had each of those games decided by a touchdown or less. And the Dogs have failed to score more than 28 points in regulation over the past 4 years against Justin Wilcox. Last year was on the road. That was a game in which the Bears really did a phenomenal job dropping back, forcing Penix to take the short completions. They were able to stretch out or shorten the game, stretch out the drives. And, it came down to a Richard Newton touchdown reception at the end of the 4th quarter to really iron that thing out. But to be fair, the previous 2 games, you had a Jake Browning that was really struggling at that particular moment. Dylan Morris led John Don offense. So not totally surprising that the scoring totals have been so low, but this Saturday should be different. We're at home. We've got Michael Penix Jr., Rome Odunze, Jalen Polk, Jeremy Bernard, Jack Westover, Jalen McMillan. I anticipate the Dogs will put up over 40 points, and it's not going to be particularly close.
I'm in agreement with you. I'm not really concerned about this game if I'm Washington. I know Washington fans have some understandable baggage when it comes to Cal. I think the one thing of note for Cal, I was just looking this up, is it does look like their star running back, Jaden Ott, is expected to return to the lineup. You know, he went down in the Auburn game, second half of the Auburn game. He did not play last week against Utah when they fell behind 17 to nothing to start the game against the Vandals. But he's
Idaho,
back.
Yeah.
And Jaden Ott is like a real player,
Yeah.
He's one of the best running backs in the conference.
Yeah. He and Martinez, I would say, are the two best running backs, and then Bucky Irving as well.
Yeah, I think that's fair for those three at the top. Cal doesn't necessarily have a consistent passing game. They've got two different quarterbacks, neither of which have been overwhelming. But like, if you're trying to create a recipe for Cal to keep this game competitive, it's a heavy dose of Jaden Ott. So him being healthy and ready to go gives them their best chance. I don't think it's going to be anywhere near enough. I think the Huskies are going to score early and score often, and it's going to break this streak of incredibly close games between these two teams.
Yeah, and you know, we mentioned some of the injuries that had cropped up last week, but this Husky defense, I think, should be pretty primed to play against this Cal offense. Tuli Lotulelei-Gastineau is really playing at a high level in that defensive tackle position. Ulamu'ale, who converted from offensive guard to defensive tackle, is really getting after it and playing free. And then we're getting back Fa'atu'i Tuitele. Cam Fab should be back. Mish Powell is playing well. He's a great tackler from that, you know, Husky position. Dominic Hampton is a bigger safety that can really come up and crash on the run. And then, you know, Edifuon Ulofosio is healthy and playing really, really good right now. So whereas last year, particularly, you know, thinking about like that Oregon game where Oregon just kind of kept running right up the middle, this team looks a lot stronger in the middle right now than they did at that time. So I don't think Cal's got the offensive creativity or the offensive power to be able to really do what they need to do to accomplish that game plan that you mentioned. But, you know, stranger things have happened. But when you look at it on paper, it seems like the Huskies are stacked up, ready for this. Like I said, I do believe that they have not yet been tested against a really quality passing attack.
Right.
But Cal's not that quality passing attack. So we won't learn anything about that until, like I said, maybe Arizona or most likely against Oregon.
Yeah, I think that's an accurate assessment. And I think if you're a Washington fan, it's a good week to just kind of watch the carnage unfold. You've got these three other games involving ranked teams. So whether it's Oregon getting a scare from Colorado or them running Colorado out of the stadium, you can enjoy it either way. You can enjoy it either way with the Cougars and the Beavers. Like, you know, you just take that in. And then at the end of the night, 7:30, the Huskies kick off, and hopefully by about 7:55, you're feeling pretty comfortable about the direction that game's headed in.
Yep. And I'm going to be at the game on Saturday. So looking forward to the first game I get to be at in person this season. The last opener of the season in Pac-12 history. And it's fitting. Washington and Cal are the two teams who have been in the pack for the longest consistent amount of time.
Oh, interesting.
So kind of a great historical footnote there. But great start to the Pac-12 season all along. Mark, are there any other, you know, games of note, whether outside of the Pac-12, that you're looking forward to heading into this weekend?
Warren, this is probably the best weekend of the year in terms of college football. We've mentioned the three heavy hitters in the Pac-12. You've also got a top 10 matchup between Ohio State and Notre Dame, in which, for the first time in a long time, Notre Dame is the team with the better quarterback. I mean, probably you'd have to go back to the Brady Quinn era to find a Notre Dame team in a game of this magnitude where you felt like they were the team with the best quarterback. So they've got a real team this year. And then you've got a couple games, Ole Miss at Alabama and Florida State at Clemson, where two established powers in Clemson and Alabama that are their playoff hopes are on life support already. They've already taken a loss in September. They haven't looked particularly impressive in their wins. And now they've got really good teams coming into their stadium to try to, you know, deal the knockout blow in a conference opener, which is just an interesting place to be in. I wouldn't be surprised if either Clemson or Alabama figures out a way to kind of pull it together. Like, those are two proud programs with really successful coaches that have faced bigger odds than this. But it is interesting to have it be this point in the season and think, gosh, I don't know that Clemson or Alabama is going to make it out of September with just one loss. So there's just, I mean, it's wall to wall action on Saturday from all corners of the country.
You know, it would be a real shame if Alabama and Clemson didn't make it into the college football playoffs. I would just be really saddened by that.
Well, I mean, think about this. You know, Warren, I said this at the beginning of the year, that the door was open for a Pac-12 team this year because all of these experienced quarterbacks, because you had Alabama, Georgia, Clemson, and Ohio State all breaking in new quarterbacks. We've already seen Alabama and Clemson lose. I think both of them are either favored or pretty much even odds, favored to lose or facing even odds this weekend. And you've got, like I said, Ohio State in a game against Notre Dame that feels like it could be a very tough challenge for the Buckeyes. So already, and Georgia was trailing by 11 points in their conference opener against South Carolina last week at the half. So we're already seeing evidence that these established powers don't have quite the same stranglehold on things that we're used to. And so maybe it's a Pac-12 team. Maybe it's a team like Michigan or Penn State or Florida State that takes advantage. But the door is open for somebody else.
Well, let's see if the Pac-12 can take advantage of this opportunity and go out in a blaze of glory. So we'll wrap things up with that, Mark. As we wrap it up, any final thoughts?
I just gave you my final thoughts.
Okay. All right. Good. Well, hey, for all of my dog fans out there, love this moment. It is good as it's going to get. Let's keep the purple blaze going, and we'll see you guys next time with Go Dogs.
And for all my Duck fans, go Ducks.
All right, we'll catch you guys next time.